gonna open up the episode with like that horrid cancer screaming. So and then you have to happy 101 episodes.
No. I think I'm going to have to stick with Walk with a Criterion Quest. That part has to stay, I think.
Yeah, but you said last week that you were going to change it up.
Change it up. So
you should just change it up this week, and then next week we'll just be like, that was shit.
Yeah.
I'm changing it back.
Yeah. Oh, here we go.
We don't even address that now.
Yeah. This is the Criterion Quest, a podcast series where we work our way through the Criterion Collection, spine number by spine number, one film at a time. I'm Chris, and sitting on the couch next to me, as always, is my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching Ingmar Bergman's horribly sad film, Cries and Whispers, from 1972.
Such a departure from his previous work.
Yeah, which is such filled with such bright, happy colours and wonderful hope and joy.
Smiles.
Yeah.
Tears of joy.
Laughter, children playing, animated ducks singing songs while wearing pants. No, This is Bergman being Bergman.
Super difficult to watch.
Yes.
Challenging.
Emotionally destroying. Yeah.
But actually, we should go into the previous 10 films.
Yeah.
That we watched because it's episode 101.
Yeah. So we'll take a look back at the previous 10 films we've explored in the series and pick what we think is our favorite. So starting off at number 91, we have The Blob. Then Fiend Without a Face, Black Narcissus, I Know Where I'm Going, All That Heaven Allows, Written on the Wind, Do the Right Thing, La Ventura, Gimme Shelter, and finishing up with the Beastie Boys video anthology.
There's a bunch of good stuff that we've had the last 10.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed most of it.
Yeah, like it was fun to start to have some good, we hadn't had some genre stuff for quite a while, so it was fun to have, you know, The Blob and Fiend Without a Face, especially the last 20 minutes of Fiend Without a Face is still fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Black Narcissus was a really fantastic visual film and fun storytelling. All That Heaven Allows was just classic Americana from the 50s. But I think for me, my number one that I've got to give it to is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. I think for me, that is not only the best film out of this bunch, but a film that has managed to stay relevant and important and impactful. As relevant and as impactful today as it was back in 1989 when it first came out.
Yeah, I mean, I think we discussed even more so.
Yeah.
Like, things have gotten worse, it seems.
Yeah. So I think for a film to pack such a punch, or, you know, nearly 30 years after it was made, is
very admirable.
Yeah. As well as the tonal balance of comedy to drama and the character developments and just the way it shot, just everything about it, I think it makes it one of, not just the best film in this lot of 10, but one of the best in the collection overall, I think.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. What about yourself?
I'm kind of torn. I think that Gimme Shelter was excellent viewing because of just the subject matter, the look. I mean, just the look into the end of the Peace and Love 60s era.
Yeah.
It was just, I mean, it sucks that people died.
Yeah.
But it's so, it's kind of such a poetic way for that era to finish.
With like the idea of we're going to put on the ultimate expression of what the 60s stood for and have it backfire.
Backfire with the
so
Hells Angels
horribly.
Killing a man.
Yeah.
Acting as bodyguards. So that was some powerful filmmaking for me. And I will, yeah, I'll give it to The Right Thing. There was actually, I mean, fucking, pretty much I enjoyed every single one of these films except for I Know Where I'm Going. Which was
just a derp-de-derp kind of romance film.
Oh, the romance film.
In the Scottish countryside of the woman waiting to go over to the island to marry her rich husband and instead falling in love with a local brash man.
Yeah.
It was fine. It was just,
It was
fucking paint by numbers.
Yeah. It
is
was
what it was.
It was rather uninteresting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I'll give it to Gimme Shelter.
Nice.
Closely followed by Beastie Boys video anthology.
Is that just for the nostalgia?
Only because of the nostalgia.
Yeah. Fair enough.
And I have to validate my single Criterion purpose.
Yeah, be like, this is the one I own, so yeah. I have to vote for that one. Yeah. But, I suppose that's a look back at the last 10, and now we'll move forward with Yeah, number 101, Cries and Whispers. Any initial thoughts before we really dive into the debate?
Is it going to be a debate? Are we going to differ in opinions that much?
I don't think so, actually. Yeah, I should have said more discussion than debate, I guess. But
you know what? When we watched Autumn Sonata, I think initially when we'd finished watching that, which was very Bergman-esque as well,
Yeah.
in that it's dramatic and sad characters developing over time.
Yep.
When we finished watching that, we started the podcast. Both of us didn't really. First of all, we didn't think we liked it, but we also didn't have a good grasp on it.
Yes.
But by the end of the discussion, we had a fairly decent grasp on it, good enough to be confident in our decision making, and we'd both actually kind of enjoy the film. So
Yeah.
I think this is going to be. Hopefully, this is the same.
Yeah.
But we're going to have to work hard.
Yes. Well, I think the difference between this and Autumn Sonata is, having now watched a few Bergman films, we kind of know what to expect going into one. And we know that it's going to be drenched in sadness, and it, like, that being said, like, impeccably shot, impeccably acted, like, all, ticking all of these boxes, but the way, the story what that he's
I don't
presenting.
think this one was that well shot.
Okay.
There's
I'll
times
debate you on
it's
that.
just yeah, well, yeah, I know you will. I'm not saying the whole thing, but
Yeah.
there's just moments where things like there's shots over shoulders. Like
Yeah.
there's a moment where this happens just it was just the little things that just irked me a little bit. Where it was a shot, for example, that was over the doctor's shoulder. And he's kind of checking Agnes, the sick woman's. Well, we should do a synopsis. She's checking Agnes's stomach, and there's a lot going on between her and her in pain and the doctor as well. But you never see his face, and I was thinking like, why wouldn't? And the frame just felt a little bit weird. So I was like, why wouldn't you frame that with them kind of side on and got
Yeah.
like a more landscape kind of.
That's interesting,
It's
yeah.
just it's not it's kind of nitpicky really.
Yeah.
But I didn't ever have that thought when I was watching stuff like
Right.
Autumn Sonata. So in comparison,
Yeah.
it's still I'm not going to say that it's like the shots were fucking crap
Yeah.
and the film should be ashamed of itself.
Yeah.
I'm just saying in comparison to Autumn Sonata, it wasn't up to that
This,
level.
yeah, fair enough. You mentioned before, like, just briefly, like, we actually haven't done a plot synopsis on this one, so
Yeah, okay.
I'll quickly summarize this one. So, we are presented with this young woman, Agnes, who is dying of, I think, some form of cancer or something. She's on her deathbed, and she's gone back to, this is the late 19th century as well, that all this is taking place. So, she's back in her childhood kind of home, this giant family mansion. And she's been looked over by her two older sisters, as well as their maid. And it's as her she slowly deteriorates and slowly is dying. It's we're presented how her death impacts the lives of those around her and those, I guess you could say, closest to her, and how that,
Well, in
yeah.
Agnes's own words,
Yes.
the only people that matter to her are her two sisters
And.
and her maid, who is a very good friend of hers.
Yes, who goes by the name Anna. So it's how her death and or her slowly dying and then her like eventual death impact the lives of these people both emotionally and physically. Yeah. So it's real uplifting stuff.
It's gonna be work. These films, whenever you tell me we're gonna do a Bergman, I am totally prepared to work.
Yeah.
Or I should say that I hope that I'm prepared to work enough. Because yeah, it's fucking just watching these ones. I kind of enjoyed the film overall.
Yeah,
There's like
so did I. I think it achieves absolutely everything it sets out to do, and it does it very, very well. I think the problem with Bergman films, though, is, like you said, you have to work with them, which isn't necessarily a problem, but they are emotionally draining, and they are not necessarily fun experiences. So that's kind of, I guess, where our displeasure, not displeasure isn't the right word, but like the reluctance, I guess, to
To jump back into them.
yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, because you've got to be up for it, right?
Yeah,
And
yeah.
so if you're doing this like we are, where we've decided to do one film a week, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. You must do it.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if you feel like it or not.
Yeah.
That's where the work comes in. But
Yes.
Anyway, this is exactly the same conversation we had with Autumn Sonata as well when we first started that podcast. I felt that the very start of the film, it took quite a long time to get the ball rolling. There was, I think, maybe 15, 20 minutes into the start, I asked myself the question, like, who are these people and what are they doing?
Yeah.
And so it was setting the atmosphere, but I didn't, it's just really unclear to me what the film was about, what it was going to be about, what we were going to be exploring.
Yeah.
So what's your opinions on that? Is it bad to linger, to make a film and not produce a tone?
Well, I think
leave
tone's,
it so fucking far in between, you know, the beginning of the film.
I think tone's the wrong choice of word, because I think with the way in which the film is shot, in particular as well, the colour palettes and everything that he's using, he's evoking a certain mood and a tone. He's establishing a tone, he's just not establishing a narrative yet.
Okay.
He's introducing you to... It's kind of like... He's emotionally setting you up for what the film is going to be. He's not... And, like, once you get acclimatized to the look and the feel and the tone of what he's doing, that's at the point in which he introduces the story and kind of elaborates a little bit for you.
To compare... This may be why I'm reaching this kind of odd conclusion, because I just watched Whiplash, and to compare... it sets the tone in within 2 minutes.
Yes.
Where it's just like the kid playing on his drums and just thrashing on him. Fletcher comes in, who's going to be the teacher, and they have this interchange between each other where one is the pupil and one is the teacher, and he's a brutal, forceful man, and then he just walks out. And that's the end of that scene, and the film is set up.
Yes.
And it took 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was really well done.
Yes, yes.
As opposed to this film where it was 15 to 20 minutes and I'm still going, I don't really know like what this film is shooting for, even in a vague sense.
Like, with using that comparison of this film to Whiplash, I think what the writer-director of Whiplash was doing, like, that is a very quick and punchy film in terms of its editing.
Oh, I see.
It's made to mimic the drumming style of it. It's very fast-paced, quick cuts, bang, bang, bang.
Okay.
And that it's a very kinetic film based on what the subject matter is. What I think Bergman does with this film in particular, and a lot of his other films, is he paints a canvas, and it's a very slow and drawn-out process.
Okay, fair call.
And that's why I think he... Like I said before, like he's taking his time to get you... acclimatized to what this film is and the world that he's putting you into, and like that doesn't include characters or narrative. It's all about look, style, and tone, and how like he's kind of trying to prepare you emotionally for what you're going to be going through, and that's why it's drawn out and it's very evenly paced, and it is just so it just wants you to soak it up and kind of appreciate. Appreciate's probably not the right word, but just absorb what is happening.
Let's say that it's mood setting.
Yes.
It's going to set your mood.
Yeah, and once you kind of clue into that's what this guy's doing and that's the tone he's setting, then he introduces the characters and... Or, like, you know, elaborates on the people we have met and then introduces the narrative.
Yeah, goes to the backstories of each of the women.
It's a very interesting style of filmmaking, and it's something that not many people do. It seems to be a very Bergman-esque thing, and I think it's necessary for his films because they are so moody and bleak that he needs to...
You can't just jump into it, yeah.
No, if we just jump straight into the cancer screams. Like... of, like, the dying of Agnes just dying. She's like... Yeah. It would be just... You'd get a nosebleed from, like, how...
Well, you probably just wouldn't even register it.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably wouldn't affect you because you'd be like... You'd start laughing at it almost.
Yeah, it's a disarming thing of, like, I need to disconnect. You'd put up barriers and just try and disconnect, yeah.
Yeah. As opposed to what did happen where we were both just like, this is horrible.
Yeah. Because he'd taken his time and we were interested. So there you go.
We started to associate ourselves with the situation.
Yeah.
And, form empathy bonds between the characters.
Yes.
Let's talk about the characters, maybe.
All right.
It's mainly...
We've got
it's really just Karen and Maria. who are the two sisters of Agnes, the dying sister. It's really exploring them most of all.
Yeah.
Did
this is how I kind of read the development between the two of them. We're kind of given that I kind of want to see if you agree or disagree. If like I've just completely missed the mark or not. We're kind of given a contrast between the two in that we have one Marie who is very physical and very emotional and very loving, and then we're given Karen who is the complete opposite to that, so much so that she doesn't like to be touched.
Yep.
But
Maria, it said by the doctor, who she must have had a previous fling with for a time.
Yes.
That she can't. They're fake touches. They're connections. She's making connections that are sensual, but they're a mask.
Yeah, which I think leads in towards to the kind of development at the end of the film of the two sisters actually finally having a connection.
Mm-hmm.
Is because them having the realization that they're not that different from each other.
Yeah. Fucking hell. These films, you can't just... I feel like this film, you can't just finish the film and then begin to talk about it and expect to get an understanding of it.
This is one where we can almost, like, come back a week later.
No, but I don't want to do that.
No, I don't want to
do that. I just want to get on with it.
Yeah.
So we're just going to keep slugging it.
Yeah.
We're going to work like we fucking said we would.
Mm-hmm.
But I did... There was, for me, about the half an hour, 35-minute mark, there was that sequence with the doctor and Maria, when Maria comes in with that...
the lacy number.
The red lacy number with her bountiful bosom.
Yeah.
And the doctor she's coming onto the doctor, and the doctor's taking her to the mirror and getting her to see her through his eyes.
Yes.
For what she really is, and that is... not a sensual, sexy woman, but a person, but a broken person.
Yes.
That just acts like a sensual, sexy woman.
Yeah, the, like, main comment is, it's like, why do you sneer so often?
Yeah.
Like, you can see the lines on your face from, like, you putting on fake emotions.
And that's when the film, for me, got quite compelling.
Yes. And that's the kind of scene where, like, I was saying before, like, I think it's very well shot, is... the way in which Bergman not only framed that, but the way in which he lets it play out, it's all played in an extreme close-up all on Marie's face.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the most subtle slow pan as it slowly moves across from one side to the other, as he's slowly describing the different elements of her face, until we finally get to the right side of her face, and the doctor is there, and he enters the close-up as well.
Yeah.
And it's
just his mouth.
Yeah. It's brilliant framing, and I think kind of the way in which he's done it, and that slow, calculated move, and then bringing us in with the doctor at the end, it's very intentional, and it works to add this kind of bigger impact to the words that he's saying, and it just lets it all play on her eyes, almost.
Well, I like that you get to study her face, and kind of... you're really trying to break down the character as well, like her character. You're making the judgments just as he is as well, but...
Yeah.
You can see, this is kind of the testament to what's her name, man?
Liv Ullmann.
Ullmann, that's right. She is such a fucking good actress.
Yes, she is. She,
that just threw me into that moment, and when you watch a film and everything, the whole universe just fades away into nothing, and it's you, just you and the screen.
Yes, yes.
So that was happening for me there.
Yeah.
And that was because of Ullman's performance. She was fucking rock and roll.
And she was doing it with nothing but a look in her eyes.
Mm. She was not talking. It was all facial expressions, obviously.
And it was absolutely spellbinding.
What else?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, where, if there were any other... That... Did that scene kind of make you... Like, obviously, like you were just saying, like, that drew you... That scene is what drew you into the film... Do you think that caused you to have more of an emotional connection with that sister versus necessarily the other one? Or did you get a kind of similar impactful kind of connection with the other one as well when we're given Karen's flashback story?
I don't know, it's kind of interesting because although you said that each sister is very similar, Maria, who is the more sensual one, quote unquote.
Yep, the Liv Ullmann one that we were just discussing. Yeah.
She seems like she's not as broken as Corinne.
But that's called into question in that scene with the Doctor when we learn that all of her emotional everything, like he figures it's all a facade.
Yeah, but she
it brings in the idea of possible doubt that she is right. as put together.
Right. But then, I don't know if I'm making a judgment call here, but it seemed like when I was looking at that and thinking about her face and thinking, why does she have those wrinkle lines over her? Maybe it wasn't just because she's become cold-hearted through her own choices. It's some part of me was thinking maybe she's just been a victim at some point, and it's just the natural rebound to just put up a shell.
Yeah.
But then I didn't get that feeling towards Corinne, who I was just like, this chick is just outright. But then again, Corinne's husband is a complete, seems like a complete monster.
Yes.
Who is, he's like a sociopath. He doesn't show any fucking empathy towards anyone, it seems. And he's just a machine.
It's crazy, right? Like, I got that exact same impression. There is nothing necessarily in the scene that leads you to assume that. He doesn't say anything untoward. He's not necessarily acting untoward. I think it's just
You're talking about the dining room scene?
Yeah. I think it's all played out through Corinne's body language towards him.
Mm-hmm.
Projects that image for the audience. And it's not necessarily anything that he does, which...
But it's also... Well, he is acting a certain way. He's
acting a little bit complacent, but... Yeah. Which you can kind of forgive because it's just a scene of, like, you know, just two people having dinner, like they do every night.
But again, there's that interesting, there's an interesting thought where you think, is Corinne a self-made monster, or is she just a
reacting
reflection
to the environment around her?
Right, exactly.
Mm.
So you're not really certain who's to blame. There's so you can it allows you to connect.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
Yeah.
With every single character, even though they are broken.
Yes. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm.
That's interesting. But yeah. So in retrospect, I feel like there was a connection. But as I was watching, it's hard to. I think with any Bergman film, any character that you have the magnifying glass to is going to be hard to connect with because they're always so disturbing.
yeah. Which it's kind of interesting. Like the idea of what you were saying just then. The Corinne being kind of broken due to her environment and in particular her husband, you kind of get the pendulum swing back the other way with Marie as well in that scene where her husband stabs himself.
I don't even know if that's an accident or whether he did it and then he's like, I fucked up.
Yeah, or like whether it was an attempted suicide and he's like, I fucked up.
God, why did I fucking put it in my intestine? I should have put it in the liver.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in that case, we're given an example where it's Marie who is causing someone else pain because of her having her infidelities and things, whether it be, you know, explicitly knows it or whatever, but yeah, it's bizarre.
I don't know, it's complex, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very complex because it is, you kind of get that double-edged thing because then you've also got, so you've got Marie being very kind of false with her emotions and the way that she puts herself out there. But then, in turn, she's also being a complacent kind of monster that pushes her husband to an attempted suicide, possibly. And then with Corinne, you have her getting kind of the opposite of that, being pushed to a breaking point by her complacent husband. But then also the way in which she treats Anna, the housemaid, and Marie as well, is kind of that... They kind of are both... ends of the spectrum. They both, the sisters kind of exhibit both sides.
Mm.
So it's kind of hard to draw, I can't find that middle ground that makes them kind of empathetic characters and ones that are easy to connect to because they swing to both ends of the emotional spectrum of just like...
But it's on, you know...
Victim and then victim, like the bully, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, their situation is understandable.
Yes.
Everybody, yeah. I mean like... It's almost like...
But it's interesting that
It's like a psychology experiment, these films.
But it's interesting as well, the way in which we presented them is we're given the idea of cat, like, it's all presented in flashback, all of this stuff, through, in and around the time where Agnes is dying. And it's interesting that the way that Bergman kind of sets it up, where we're given first Marie, who is like the kind of fun emotion, like the one who wears her emotions on her sleeve and things,
mm-hmm.
and then we're given a flashback story that, that shows the opposite of that. And then for Karen, Karim, we've shown a woman who seems to be cold and emotionless, and then we're shown the the opposite of this. It's kind of very interesting and fucking excellent filmmaking, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
In between the, I don't know how to read into this. Maybe you can help me. In between all the flashbacks, there's this constant fade to red.
Yep.
What does the red mean? Because there is red everywhere.
According to Bergman, fuck it. I only have a little bit of trivia, but this is one of them. So I'll just jump in now for the discussion.
All right.
So Bergman explained that the use of the color red in the film is an exploration of the soul. And ever since his childhood, this is a quote from him, and ever since childhood, I've imagined the soul to be a damp membrane in varying shades of red.
That's very odd.
Yes. So the idea of the house being completely red-walled, red-carpeted and everything,
mm-hmm.
it's the idea, I think, of these characters going back into... taking a trip into their souls, which are basically their childhood home, like what created them, where they came from and things. So it's an inward kind of journey like that. And we use the red to transition from modern day to the flashbacks because it's people having a look inside their own souls.
So there's like a reflection.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good.
Mm.
Okay, that sorts that problem out.
Yes. Tick it off the list.
I did notice in between, often at night time, there's always... I mean, there's no music except for one scene,
which is...
we'll figure out. We'll talk about in a sec, I suppose.
Yep.
But other than that, there is no music, and often there'll just be just a howling wind, which I felt like that was a bit stronger during the night time.
Yeah.
But the fact that you would put no music in and just ambient howling wind makes this film even harder to stomach. If you just, I mean, because most of the time you're literally listening to people breathe.
Yeah.
Sometimes their breathing is very hard to listen to.
Yeah.
Or you're listening to the breath of the wind.
Yeah.
It's also fucking bleak.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think he's done it consciously. Like, I mean, obviously it's on purpose that there is no music until this one crucial scene, which we'll get to. But I think it is to add to the kind of hollowness of it all.
Okay.
Yeah, that was kind of my take on it, in particular with the wind and the breathing. I think that the wind is almost supposed to mimic Agnes's trouble breathing, I think. And
okay.
It's kind of adds in this element.
Like the house.
And the
house breathes as well, and it's aged.
Yes, and it kind of adds into this element for the other characters that it is Agnes's death is inescapable. Like, even if they're not on shift looking after and caring for her, there is still this ever-present noise and sound that reminds them of her death going on.
Okay.
Hmm.
Oh, very good call. I like that.
Well, I mean, we've kind of set it up a little bit, so we'll jump into the actual scene about where there is music. It's kind of interesting, yeah. So the whole film is stark until we finally get a bit of an explosion of emotions between Agnes and Karen. And Marie and Karen. And when we get to the two of them... I guess having their resolution or their emotional breakthrough, and what made me to believe that they get to the realization of they aren't dissimilar. It's just they're like, as I said, like, god damn it, this is a hard one to explain.
Yeah.
The two emotional sides that they both have on the inside and their outside do mirror each other and make them as similar people. When they have this somewhat breakthrough and realization, we're not participant to it. Bergman cuts the audio and it's all just music, and he just lets you play out on the visual of these two people having an emotional breakthrough and a realization.
Yeah, well, that they've grown.
Yes.
Like the character arc is complete pretty much, and you know, Maria, who couldn't who was always false in her connections, is finally able to touch somebody and mean it.
Yeah.
And then Karen can just now finally touch someone
and be touched by them
and be
turn.
Touched as well. So
it's interesting though, in a film that has been very stark and bleak and emotion like dealing with raw emotion at that point where you would assume it is like the heightened of this, we find that's when he decides to bring in the score and the music and just let that help illustrate the point. It's very well done.
Yeah.
I think by having that be the only scene in the film that has music, I mean, obviously, is a key clue to the audience. Like, this is important right
yeah.
now.
But plus it felt like all of the tension was finally lifted. I mean, you're sitting through, you know, an hour and 20 minutes of bleak, difficult fucking shit
yeah.
on a screen with horrible breathing and nothing much else.
Yeah.
To finally get a wonderful piece of music.
Yeah.
And being presented with two people that are loving each other.
It's the sigh of relief.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. But then, unfortunately, he rips us back in because then we're presented with Anna, the maid's kind of story, which, after we've kind of had this emotional resolution between these two sisters, realize we're presented it from an outside point of view where it's just like, oh no, these two people are just fucking horrible cunts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, pieces of shit.
She had that dream sequence, though.
Yes. Which I kind of viewed as her trying to get the two sisters to emotionally connect the way that she is with Agnes dying, and it's just she's unable to get them to even communicate because they're kind of attempting to talk a little bit, but it's voiceless, they won't make eye contact, and it's just this kind of illustrates the kind of emotional emptiness that Anna is perceiving these two to have towards their dying sister, and it kind of emphasizes the fact that she is being the primary caregiver and that she feels she has a more of an emotional connection to this woman. And then that's just kind of toppled after she actually dies, and the family's just like, nah, like, you can stay here till the end of the month, and then you gotta fuck off.
You are not our responsibility.
You're not our responsibility. Here's $20 for your troubles. It's brutal. But at least Bergman kind of brilliantly brings us out of this trench of sadness to the final scene where it's Anna reading Agnes's diary and finding out that this woman who died a horrible death did, in fact, love all of these people, Anna included, and found moments of happiness and peace in her life and her death.
But was that her final?
No.
Was that her final entry, though?
No.
I felt like it was, or is it a previous one? Because I think it's a previous one.
Possibly.
Listen to this then, because I thought when I was reading it that it seems like she's talking about it not when they were, for them to be this broken now, all of the sisters to be this broken now, would have taken a long time.
Yeah.
And you would expect that they would have been, if they were healthy, mentally healthy, at some point they would have been it when they were children.
Yeah.
And then just been broken over time.
Yeah.
So to me, that flashback was not, it didn't really feel like it was them as children again.
No. I think it was when she was first becoming very ill, and it was when her two sisters had come to move into the house to help take care of her with Anna.
Okay.
It was at that point when they were all reunited again, and before her, she got really, really bad and was done, like, you know, as we see her throughout the majority of the
film. Yeah. Well, she did mention that she had been sick,
yeah,
and that she was having trouble.
Yeah, like, but I think it's at the point where the other two have come, like, knowing that their sister is going to die, so it's kind of that last happy moment of them all being together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a nice...
I don't know, but then there's nothing to contradict the idea that it might be just the final entry that's fictional, and she's gone, you know, it's complete, like, my sisters are broken, but I love them, and I wished we had this day.
That's interesting,
I wish that this was my final day.
Okay, yeah, that's a cool read of that, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, there's nothing to... Well, yeah, but, you know...
It's
Bergman, and she's escaping from, like, her final day, like, the most painful day for her, potentially.
That's a lovely way to read it, yeah, I like that.
So there's nothing that I can't find anything that contradicts that.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that really... I mean, that kind of adds a little bit more to Agnes's point of view, because you don't really get much of Agnes.
Yeah. Well, no, she...
You don't really get much of Agnes. She's always just the person that's...
Death is facilitating the emotional journey the other characters are going through.
That's right, but
She's the catalyst. She is not the protagonist. Yeah.
That's why I like the idea of reading it that way, because you get a little bit of an insight into Agnes, finally.
Yep.
And that all she really wanted was to just hang out with her sisters and be loved by them and to love them.
Mm.
And then, to me, that kind of like wraps up the film, at least in kind of a nice little bow.
Yeah.
When you can treat it like, you know, you can... It's the important things are your connections with people.
Yeah.
That's what happiness is, when you have a good connection with someone or something.
Yeah, no, I think it's spot on.
So... I don't know, again, Bergman does this again.
Yeah.
It's a bleak film, but you can watch it and read into it and discover that it's actually quite a hopeful thing too.
Yeah, yeah, you do get those moments that where he does explore the other side of the... Like, it's... Yeah.
And there's boobs in it.
Boobs and butts, which helps.
This film, to me, was like, if it was on, it'd be like on SBS.
Yeah.
You know, late night. SBS for
people overseas.
You'd be like,
this is
overseas.
A weird Swedish film from the 60s. I know I'm going to see some nudity.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to watch the shit out of this as an adolescent teenage boy. And SBS for people overseas is our...
A kind of arty channel that we have. Yeah. A government-owned one that would play like very... We'd find a lot of foreign television and a lot of foreign films. And it was kind of like good.
And late night, before you had pay-per-view...
Or the internet.
Or internet or anything, you'd go on SBS as an adolescent teenage boy and expect to see nudity.
But
you would try. If this came on, I would try.
Yeah.
Because out of context, you'd have to push all the context away, otherwise it just wouldn't work.
But then that scene eventually ends up with her shoving a shard of glass into a vagina and cutting herself up real good.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't work.
No, it wouldn't work.
Unless I was into that as a teenage boy, but I'm not. Some teenage boys
could
love
if that
this
is
movie
your king,
for the...
then you are set for this. But yeah, no, I think we've gotten to the good emotional core of this film, and I think we've done it a bit of justice in our discussion. And I think
a little bit. I don't know.
I've got a nice enough understanding of it. I think, and I mean, I enjoyed the film. It is like Orberg and really a fucking slog when you're actually watching it, but in hindsight, and once you actually make your way through it all, you understand it is like. Why he is a heralded filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
and you can appreciate the films.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, like, I'd like to... I'm in awe of people that can really nut these ones out.
Yes.
Because, to me, it hinges on so much shit. Like, you need to know so much technical film stuff. You need to know so much psychology stuff.
That's it.
You need to know so many things to fully appreciate
this
film.
We're attempting this on a single watch as well. So,
I always read essays and stuff like that.
Yeah, after the film, I quickly had a read of Peter Cowie's article that's up on the Criterion website of this one, and kind of, you know, it didn't really go into that much of a depth into the film, but it's an interesting read. So. And I haven't kind of stolen from him.
Good.
I want to make that clear. But yeah, I don't know, have you got any final thoughts before we jump into trivia?
Nah.
No? Alrighty. So the film was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Costume Design, and it won for Best Cinematography.
Good Best Picture for an international film.
Yeah, which is extremely rare.
Yeah.
I think the last time that happened, was Life is Beautiful. That was the last time I can think of that happening.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I haven't really delved that far back into the 70s and things of the Academy to look into it a bit more, but a rare occasion where that happened. It didn't get nominated for Best Foreign Film. It got nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, but if it's in Best Picture, why does it
need a foreign film nomination? It's a bit of a double up at that point.
Yeah.
It was also nominated for the Best Foreign Language Film at the Golden Globes, Best Supporting Actress and Best Cinematography at the BAFTAs, and was named Best Foreign Language Film, one of the top 10 films of the year, and Best Director by the National Board of Review, and it won the Technical Grand Jury Prize at Cannes.
Oh my god.
So it is a very lauded film, this one.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other piece of information, trivia I had, because we'd already kind of gone into the explanation of the Reds, was that Bergman, who produced the film with his own money, could not find an American distributor, as they felt that this film was too uncommercial. Famously, Roger Corman, the awesome kind of exploitation and B-grade filmmaker, who had just left American International Pictures to set up his own New World releasing company, was in the market for a prestige picture to give his new operation some class, and bought the distribution rights to this one.
Very nice.
So this, along with kind of making things like Piranha and fucking...
From the distributors of Piranha.
Comes Cries and Whispers.
Cries and Whispers, the Bergman film.
Yeah, so that's kind of cool. It proves Roger Corman's the fucking man.
That's cool.
Interesting one. But that's all I've got for trivia on this one. So we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film was recently re-released on a one-disc Blu-ray and is still available as a two-disc DVD set, as well as being on iTunes and Hulu Plus. But the physical editions come with an introduction by director Ingmar Bergman from 2001, new interview with actor Harriet Anderson, conducted by historian Peter Cowie, On Solace, a new video essay by filmmaker, good lord, that's a weird name, Kogunada. But it's all, it's like two colons, Kogunada. It's all lowest back. It's a weird one.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Some artist person, I'm assuming. behind the scenes footage with commentary by Cowie. Ingmar Bergman, reflections on life, death, and love with Erland Josephson. A 52-minute interview with Bergman and his longtime collaborator, as well as trailers, a new English dub soundtrack, and new translations for the subtitles. So, pretty good edition.
I don't know if I would ever watch a dubbed Bergman.
I can't watch any dubbed films anymore. I find them fucking horrible and distracting, and can't do it. Even, like, animated stuff, like... anything I can't do.
Some of the Studio Ghibli stuff's tolerable. I think you're getting pretty A-class.
Yeah, and I think possibly I could maybe, if I ever went back and rewatched Neon Genesis, the TV series, I could probably do it dubbed because I, you know, nostalgia.
But it seems wrong to watch a dubbed film.
Yeah.
Because the actors have done their job.
Yeah.
And they're portraying their character in their way.
Exactly, and without having the emotional impact that's coming across from their performance and their words. Something's lost in translation at that point.
It'd be like getting it's like a text message.
Yeah.
Where you've lost fucking 70% of the information.
Yeah, exactly. You can't read the proper, you don't know if what you're hearing is the proper inflection and the tone and
So fuck that.
Fucked dub version.
Dub version.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
But I guess that'll probably wrap us up on that hateful note about dubbed films. Oh, no. Looking at this week's film, Cries and Whispers. We'll be back next week with a Louis Bunuel film. I think it's our first one of his in the collection. The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie.
That sounds exciting. Yes.
I have not seen it, but I've heard a lot of good things, and I don't mind our Louis Bunuel. So, yeah.
Cool.
But if you have any comments or queries, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @CriterionQuest. But for this week's episode, I am Chris.
I'm Tom. Hello.
You bizarro was.
Well, I'm changing my ending too.
That's not gonna work.
See ya. Yeah.